Broadcasting from the Gulag City of America, this is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker. Our engineer is Steve Nolan. Cheryl's here to man the phones. Our guest list for tonight includes Jacob Solem, the author of Saying Yes in Defense of Drug Use. We'll hear from Ed Rosenthal, the guru ganja. We'll also hear from next week's guest, Judge James P. Gray. And we have a recent guest of the Harris County Jail here with us tonight. His name is Tony. A little bit of news to start the evening. Today, the British Broadcasting Company posted a story that shows Afghanistan is now, once again, the world's leading producer of the opium poppy. They also stated that the U.S. government has decided to do nothing about that. So now we're spending billions of dollars in Colombia to fight the growth of drugs, killing thousands and thousands of peasants each year. But perhaps, given that allowing the warlords of Afghanistan to profit from selling drugs will keep the U.S. from having to dip too far into their pocketbook to rebuild the country, is this a good thing? Certainly hypocrisy rules here in the U.S. It's just getting hard to tell anymore. Now comes word that District Attorney Terry McEachern, the man who gained notoriety as the prosecutor of the 1999 Tulia drug bust, well, he was recently found guilty of aggravated driving while intoxicated, and his local constituents think he should step down or be removed from office. He's the district attorney for Hale and Swisher counties, and he was convicted this past Tuesday by a New Mexico district court judge on a charge stemming from a November 27th traffic stop by a Ruidoso, New Mexico police officer. I think as a DA, he's supposed to be an example, not a lawbreaker, said Ronnie Green, a 50-year-old Plainview painter. A video showing McEachern talking and failing the sobriety test was recorded by the patrol unit's camera and became evidence in the trial. If you do the crime, I guess you have to do what's right. He shouldn't get a break just because he was serving the law. Today, the Houston Chronicle had a few stories for us about the drug war. First off, our illustrious police chief has fired some of his staff at our now infamous crime lab. It seems that after 7 years of effing up, he's had enough. Just as well, I suppose, him and Chuck Rosenthal, knowing full well their crime lab was an enormous joke, went ahead and arrested and prosecuted thousands of individuals anyway. These guys wouldn't know justice if it bit him on the butt, but I hope it does anyway. Another story jumps out from the Chronicle as well, one that serves to once again, every friggin' day now, to show the corruption and greed that runs so deep within our criminal justice system. It seems that an Austin police dispatcher has now shown to be part of a massive international drug ring. He was arrested by the DEA on federal conspiracy charges and is part of a sprawling drug smuggling ring that has operations from Mexico to Chicago. His name is Maccabee Mimmon. He's 28 and he posted bond and was released Thursday from a federal detention center in the border city of Del Rio. Federal agents believe that Mimmon is an associate of a drug ring that has smuggled about 10,000 pounds of marijuana from Mexico to several U.S. cities, most notably Chicago. Quote, they bring in dope from Eagle Pass in Del Rio, store it in Austin and San Antonio, and move it around to other places up north, said Javier Pena, a spokesman for the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. One more bit of good news. It seems that the Texas legislature has finally declared war on the paramilitary forces that have been raiding innocent Texas citizens. Again, according to the Chronicle, five of the paramilitary narcotics task forces in Texas have been shut down. And one last happy note, the remaining prisoners from the Tulia drug sting are due to be released this coming Tuesday. I'm going to try to bring you some reports about the party that's sure to follow. I guess that's about it for the news. We're going to hear a song, The Ballad of Dennis Perrone.
I'm going to tell you the story of Dennis Perrone, our neighborhood dealer, well-liked and well-known. His stuff was organic. It was always on sale, and now he's facing more time in jail. How many ways, how many times must we be the victims of victimless crimes? Coming out of the service, finally free, an idealist, wondering what shall I be? Living with friends in a house in the hate, he decided a new kind of space to create. It was a place you could come to and hang out and try gold in the old days, Colombian tie, and listen to music and choose what you want without giving strangers no money up front. They didn't sell hard drugs, no downers, no speed, only some mild magic mushrooms and weed. And hippies and housewives and hard hats came, and Dennis knew everyone by their first name. How many ways, how many times must we be the victims of victimless crimes?
That was the ballad of Dennis Perrone. I think it's worth noting that the song was produced by the assistant to the district attorney of San Francisco. Okay, we have with us tonight, as I said, in the studio, a guest. His name is Tony, and he just spent some time in the Harris County Jail. Good evening, Tony.
Good evening, Dave.
Yeah, I'm curious. As I understand it, the judge who sat on the grand jury to indict you was also the same judge who sat to convict you. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Seems like some sort of preparation for a conviction, doesn't it?
It's almost like a setup. I don't understand the whole system because I don't understand how things go as far as one person being able to be on the indictment of my case and the same person being the person that's sitting on the, you know, he's the judge in the court where I'm going to be prosecuted or to be tried in the case.
Yeah, Harris County's got a lot of problems to fix, if you ask me. Tony, the way I understand it, you know, you had a minor amount of cocaine. Tell the listeners out there what sentence you got.
I got 5 years deferred adjudication. They were trying to give me 5 years in TDC, but with the situations of my family and the situation of my life, I tried to make it to where I could, instead of being incarcerated in the system, take care of my family and everything else, because what it would basically do is throw my whole family in the welfare system. I asked for them to give me a deferred adjudication so that I could at least stay home and take care of my family.
The way I understand it, you know, once you're in custody, you're part of a robot force. If one gentleman happens to screw up in the tank or the holding area you're in, everybody gets punished. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Everyone's punished for the whole thing. If one person gets in an altercation with another inmate, or if he gets in an altercation with one of the deputies on staff, first thing they do is chastise every person in the unit. There's anywhere from 30 to 50 people in a unit. And instead of being able to go out for recreation and stuff like that, because one person made a mistake, we all suffer because of it.
Yeah, it's amazing. I don't know, the laziness, I guess, of dealing with people in that fashion, rather than punish the one man having to write up the do the paperwork. They just felt it more appropriate to punish everybody.
Basically, yeah, because they don't want to do any more work than they have to, because they're just looking to get their time in so that they can get their easy retirement. That's the general consensus of everything I heard the whole time I was in there.
Well, on occasion, you get to see what these deputies are up to, and for the most part, you say they're in there surfing the net, maybe occasionally hitting the porn sites.
At times, yeah, late at night, you know, because everybody's got to be in bed, you know, 10 o'clock. And so the guys come in at night, and they come in there, and they sleep, and they get on the internet, and they bring in their laptops and they call the girlfriends and they've all got their cell phones. So it gives them, you know, it gives them something to do to spend their time enjoyably, and they're still bringing in a nice check.
Yeah, ain't that the truth? Well, Tony, we're going to discuss this more throughout the night. Listeners out there, if you want to give us a call, we don't have an expert here, but between me and Tony, we figure we got about 75 years of experience in this regard, and we'll be glad to answer any questions you might have. Our number here, 713-526-5738. A little earlier today, we had a situation where I spoke with Jacob Solem, the gentleman you heard at the intro there, who wrote the book Saying Yes in Defense of Drug Use.
First off, I want to thank you for being part of the New York Times Drug Policy Forum today.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
If the listeners out there would like to to see the discussion. They'll be able to see it starting Monday at the New York Times website, www.nytimes.com. And you can get more information at cultural-baggage.com as well. Jacob, as always, it's a very hectic pace in one of these forums, and we were unable to get to many of the questions. Yes, I noted in your book there are several instances where, throughout the past couple of centuries, users of other products, be that alcohol or tobacco, were equally demonized and, said it would drive them crazy or kill them and so forth. Discuss
right.
that
parallel. And it's quite striking if you look at the history of the so-called temperance movement, which, of course, it started out as a temperance movement, meaning that you shouldn't drink to excess, but it ended up being an abstinence movement and then a prohibitionist movement. And I think that was a fundamental mistake, and it's one that we basically have rejected because we did repeal prohibition, and most Americans now say that they understand that most drinkers are not alcoholics and that there is such a thing as responsible drinking. But if you look at the history of the anti-alcohol movement, all of the themes that you see in today's anti-drug propaganda come up again and again. So any allegation that has been made against an illegal drug has also been made against alcohol and usually first. One of the most striking things that people not widely recognize is the idea of drugs being inherently addicting, such that you try them once and you will inevitably escalate your use until you can't do without it and it's going to ruin your life. And that image was actually popularized by dry activists, anti-alcohol activists in the 19th century. Before any of the opiates had that reputation, alcohol had that reputation, that's something that sociologist Harry Levine pointed out back in the 70s. So that's one example, and of course you can think of other kinds of fears that are associated with drugs. In addition to addiction, there's the fear of violence, which is certainly something that's been tied to alcohol. The fear of sloth, that people will just be intoxicated all the time and not accomplish anything. The fear of sex, of lust, sexual promiscuity obviously has been associated with alcohol. So you go down the line and you see that all of these fears at one time or another have been linked to alcohol, sometimes still are, but that somehow we have managed to deal with alcohol without prohibiting it anyway. So my point is that even to the extent that there is some truth to these concerns, and obviously some of these concerns are valid to some extent, you can control the problem, and in fact you have a better chance of controlling the problem if the drugs are legal. And the other striking thing is the way that these charges about what drugs make you do move from substance to substance over the years. One of the more striking examples involves anti-tobacco propaganda from the turn of the 20th century. If you look at how they described young people who smoked tobacco cigarettes, it is strikingly similar to the way that marijuana smokers are described today. They didn't actually use the term amotivational syndrome, but the idea was that if you smoked tobacco, specifically tobacco cigarettes, that you would end up accomplishing nothing, that you would fail at school, you wouldn't be able to hold a job. And this was what, believed by not just isolated cranks, but some very influential, well-known, highly educated people who actually succeeded in getting cigarette sales banned in a number of states. Now, it comes, and this is back in the teens that this was going on, so it's 90 years later or so, you hear very similar things said about marijuana. And, of course, these are very different drugs, even though they're both dried-up plants that people smoke. So it seems pretty clear what's going on is that there are fears that people always have about the younger generation, that their kids are not going to be successful, they're not going to be productive. And those fears get projected on to whatever the chemical menace of the day happens to be. And you see that kind of thing again and again with different fears, different drugs, oftentimes very drugs that are quite different in their effects. The same fear is associated with them.
Okay, that was Jacob Solem, the author of Saying Yes in Defense of Drug Use. We'll be hearing more from him. I have several segments, but this gives me and Tony a chance to talk. And again, if you want to call us, 713-526-5738. Tony, when I was in county jail, this has been a quarter century ago, They had a system whereby they had these gentlemen they call the boss of the tanks. And every Sunday they would have a battle royale to see who was the biggest, baddest son of a gun in there. And he got to run it. And the officers would work the system through that one man and his little army. Is it still that way?
Well, to a point, yes. You know, certain cliques, the guys that's been in there the longest get a little more respect because they've been there longer. The deputies develop a little bit of a relationship with the guys. They get to know them a little bit and talk to them some. But the big thing in there is that, you know, everybody busts up in little bitty cliques and things, and they run their own little groups instead of one person actually being in charge, you know. Depending on who you are, you could bounce somebody off a locker or off of a bunk or something like that. And certain people, you can get away with things like that where someone else might get written up or, you know, something else could happen to them. You know, they could catch another case while they were inside. It depends on how long you've been in there on what kind of status you got.
Right. I understand. Now, you know, the meals were always crappy. I remember that. It was a lot of bologna sandwiches is what I recall that we would get.
Not much good.
Now, they do have the commissary still, but I understand it's like some kind of, you know, twilight zone. You're paying 10 times the amount for this food of what it's worth on the street. Is that right?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, yeah, that's true. Because, you know, you get those ramen noodles, the little packs of noodles and stuff like that. Well, you take those little packs of noodles at the store, you can get them for 8 or 10 for $1 or something like that. They're 45 cents a piece in county jail. And, you know, among other things, you know, a soda, a 20-ounce soda is a dollar and a nickel. You're only allowed to get so many of certain things. But the things that you can get the most of are the things that the biggest profit margin, based upon the people that actually are out there on the street and buy groceries before they get incarcerated, realize those prices are a little outrageous when you get in there. And they're only allowed to spend about $100 a week. Well, that's a lot of food to eat, but to spend it, it doesn't go very far. And there's a lot of money made somewhere.
I hear you, man. Yeah, well, we're not going to go point fingers, but we'll talk to Ray Hill and see what we can find out about just who's making this money, because it sure doesn't go to, you know, inmate trust fund.
No, I don't think it's going towards education funds or anything like that to help the inmates so that they can come out and be better citizens. I think it's more about incarcerating them so that somebody can make a living off of it.
Well, ain't that the truth again? I tell you what, when I last was there, there was a lot of violence. Lots of violence. We're talking about the late 60s and early 70s, the times I visited. Is it still as violent in jail?
Yeah, most of the time when things happen, though, they happen after rack time, because by then most of the deputies are pretty much involved in their own little things. They put their headphones on, so people, when they're bunked up, can't hear what's going on. You know, they can't hear us or what's going on out in the units. And if you got something against somebody in a unit, usually just wait till after rack time. And then after you hit rack time, everybody goes to bed, and the bosses put their headphones on and stuff like that. They don't hear anything. You know, a couple of guys want to work a guy over, that's the time they do it.
I hear you, Tony. Well, I tell you what, we're going to take another listen here to Jacob Solem.
There was a question posed on the forum, and you delve into it quite thoroughly in your book, the fact that the pharmaceutical houses basically fund the Office of National Drug Control Policy and help determine their evaluation of these drugs. Would you discuss that?
Well, in particular, pharmaceutical companies have given money to, and still do, give money to the Partnership for a Drug-Free America. And, you know, that's obviously ironic, because they don't really want a drug-free America. That would be really bad for their business if that happened. And so clearly, to some extent, they're fighting potential competitors with their products. In some cases, of course, these companies may produce things that are specifically aimed at treating drug abuse or detecting drug users. I mean, they're companies that make drug tests and obviously profit from the drug war in that sense.
You shouldn't underestimate people's ability to rationalize their behavior and to believe that what's in their interest is also in the country's interest. And I think for the most part, people who argue in favor of prohibition or who give money to support these causes are quite sincere. In other words, they themselves believe that what they're doing is in the public interest, and they don't see themselves as cynically manipulating the political process in order to pocket some extra money.
My question was, there's a gentleman on tonight's show. He recently spent some time in the Harris County Jail, courtesy of an analysis done by the now infamous Houston Crime Lab. How often do you hear stories of this nature?
Well, I mean, it's a special problem in connection with drug crimes and other crimes where you don't really have a complainant.
In other words, it's consensual behavior they're trying to criminalize. A lot relies upon police testimony, for example, about who touched the drugs, who had what drugs when. You often hear stories about what they call testifying by police officers who plant drugs on people or who simply report that they found the drugs on people. You know, in that case, there's no victim to say, no, that wasn't the guy who did it, because there is no victim. So you could say it's always a problem the police might be corrupt, but it's a special problem when it comes to consensual activity that's been banned, because there's nobody to contradict the cop and say, no, that's not the guy who did it.
Again, Jacob Sullum. We do have a caller on line one. I see it's Brandon. Let's go ahead and bring him on. Hello, Brandon.
Hello.
Hey, good evening. Do you have a question for us?
Yeah, I was just actually calling to check on the progress of the bill in the state's legislature. I haven't been able to watch the news very much, and I was just checking to see. I heard that we were class. Sorry, I'm really tired, dude. Possession of an ounce was supposed to be moved to a Class C, and I was just seeing the progress of that, if you knew of it.
It actually had the impetus to get through the legislature.
Right.
But it had the, surreptitious veto of the governor.
Right.
Already in place. So it did not make it through.
Yeah, it was a given. I was just seeing if, how far we got and, maybe we had another rally coming up pretty soon, if it was going back in or not.
Well, sad to say, it didn't make it this time. The legislature would have passed it. The governor would have vetoed it. So people bowed out rather than. One thing that did make it through was the bill that would make treatment possible instead of incarceration for those arrested with less than a gram of, hard drugs.
Right.
But again, we've got to wait and see if the governor will sign it. We might make him coward of the week next go round. I'm not sure. We'll see what he does.
Or see who's in the governor's seat in a couple of years, right?
Yeah. Let's hope. Let's hope somebody else can replace this guy.
Indeed. Have a good night.
Thank you, Brandon.
You too.
All right. We do have some calls coming in. I want to advise you to give us a shout here. 713-526-5738. Tony, I had the situation where you were unable to reach your home, via phone because of a scenario we won't get into at the moment, but, you were able to reach me and I took the calls. You're a close enough friend. I thought it only right and appropriate, but I found out when my phone bill came in, I'm getting charged about
$3.90 a call.
$3.90 a call. Now that money doesn't go to AT&T, as I understand it. It actually goes to, powers that be within Harris County, individuals.
Yeah, from the information that I've obtained today and in the last few days, it does go to certain pertinent information of certain individuals. I'm sure AT&T gets their cut, and I'm sure Southwestern Bell gets their cut, and they're getting a big cut at $3.90 a call.
Right, and certain officials. I love when you call, when those inmates call. $3.90 a pop, folks. Wait, what is it? 35 cents? 50 cents is in a phone booth?
I think it's 50 cents in a payphone now.
Yeah. I tell you what. I hesitate to say this, but we know what's going to happen. This will remain on your record. This is going to make it hard, almost impossible perhaps, for you to rent apartments, to get loans, to enroll in school, maybe even to vote. This has been... they say it's a minor, a penalty, but it's a hellacious penalty, isn't it?
Right. I'll be stuck with it for the rest of my life. And due to the circumstances and the way things happened, it wasn't really warranted to me. I really didn't deserve what I got. But, everyone's got their own story. The sad part about it is that the system's not willing to listen to us when we're willing to sit down and talk to them and explain to them the entire situation, because everybody's situation is basically the same according to what the judicial system, what they want to do to us. They've already pretty much pre-decided on what they're going to do.
Yeah, it's all, when you got the judge indicting you and convicting you, yeah, it's pretty well predetermined, if you ask me.
It's an in-house operation. I'd like to know how many of them got their hands in the kitty somewhere in the big system.
Okay, I see we have a couple of callers online, but please give us a shout, 713-526-5738. We're going to hear a little bit more from Jacob Sullum, and we'll be back to take some calls.
Many politicians are afraid to even discuss this issue. They don't want to appear soft on crime, and yet you consider the fact that they talk about how, you know, drugs fund terrorists and gangs and so forth. But could we not, through regulation, immediately end the profits for those drug lords and those gangs and the street corner vendor who wants to sell to our children?
Right. Well, I think that it's a sign of a real desperation on the government's part that they have resorted to this argument that ties drug use to violence, whether it's violence by drug traffickers themselves or violence by terrorists who are supported by drug profits, because obviously that whole, you know, problem is created by prohibition. You would, first of all, criminals would not be running this business if it weren't for prohibition. That's the first problem. Secondly, the prohibition multiplies the profits many times over. So to the extent that, you know, terrorists can support their activities through the drug trade, that is simply because of prohibition. If you didn't have prohibition, they wouldn't be able to support themselves that way any more than they'd be able to support themselves by going into, you know, the grocery business or selling books. So it's precisely the prohibition that creates that connection and also leads to the violence that is committed by drug traffickers and drug dealers, either competing with each other or fighting with the government. You don't see that kind of violence in a legal market. You saw it during alcohol prohibition with rival gangs fighting each other, shooting at each other in the streets, and sometimes killing innocent people. But you don't see that anymore. You don't see liquor store owners or, you know, the manufacturers of alcoholic beverages shooting at each other in the streets. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that that wasn't a consequence of drinking. It was alcohol-related in the sense that it was connected to that black market, but it wasn't alcohol-related in the sense that, you know, the gangsters were going around drunk all the time. So it really is a tremendous chutzpah on the government's part to say, this is your fault if you use drugs, when in fact it's the government that created the problem.
Okay, we've got David next up here on the line. We'll go ahead and take his call here in just a second. Want to invite the rest of you out there to give us a call, 713-526-5738.
This is Cliff Schaefer. You're listening to Cultural Baggage on KPFT Houston.
First, it was anthrax, then the threat of smallpox, VX nerve gas, and the Ebola virus. Next came SARS, then the new and improved monkeypox. These threats have nothing on the most debilitating disease of all time, the one that has caused otherwise normal policemen to go berserk and shoot innocent civilians all across this nation. The disease that has ravaged America and much of the world for nearly a century. Drug war fever. Once under its influence, those stricken try their best to destroy the lives of otherwise decent and law-abiding citizens. Lies, deceit, corruption, and violence are signs of those who have fallen under its spell. All Americans are advised to be on the lookout for anyone with drug war fever.
This is Mark Greer, Executive Director of Drug Sense. You're listening to Cultural Baggage on 90.1 KPFT in Houston. To end the drug war, visit MAPINC.org. That's MAPINC.org. Get active, stay aware, stay informed, and let's bring an end to this nonsense.
All right, this is Activist Corner. We've got a few things coming up this coming week. The Drug Policy Forum of Texas will be having their monthly meeting. That's on Monday the 16th, starting at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Church. That's located Southmore at Fannin. Then coming up next Thursday on the 19th, Houston Normal will be having their monthly meeting. That'll be held over at Chapultepec's Mexican Restaurant at 7:30 p.m. That's located 813 Richmond. We're going to be having elections this meeting, so y'all be sure to come out. And then one last thing, Cop Watch Radio will be having their program coming up on the 24th at midnight on here at KPFT. That's about it for Activist Corner. Back to you, Dean.
Thank you, Steve. He's been waiting a while. Steve, let's go ahead and pick up line two, talk to David. Hello, David.
Hi, Dean. How you doing?
I'm well this evening. How are you, sir?
I'm doing really good.
Yes, did you have a question for us or a comment?
Well, it's a comment, and I want to thank you for your show and the topics you cover. It's very important. But I'm going to play the devil's advocate here. I want to talk on what Tony was talking about the shakedowns in the unit and how everyone gets blamed for one person.
All right, go ahead.
And I do want to agree that everyone does get blamed for one person's thing, I just went through a shakedown in Chambers County for two 18-year-old punks trying to make some tattoo ink. And, you know, we went through a shakedown, but what these kids were doing was wrong. And they had contraband inside the unit. And, you know, I was in Chambers County, and all these guys, a lot of these fucking guys in the working these shifts are really decent kids, and kids is what they are. And
are you talking about the officers?
Yeah, they're working the units. Yeah.
Okay. Why, sir? You're talking about deputies.
Deputies, officers, I was in Chambers County is what I'm talking about, and all these guys work for the Chambers County Sheriff's Department. And, you know, these guys are out there, and a lot of these guys in the units make it harder on themselves.
When they rolled the unit, did they take all your contraband, everyone's?
What?
Did they take everyone's contraband, anything you had that wasn't in the original containers and stuff like that, like your coffees and stuff? When they rolled your unit, did they take everything from you for just what these two guys did?
Nah, they didn't take anything but contraband. I was in for the weekend, and they found three whetstones. They found all kinds of razor blades. They found tobacco stashed in people's mattresses. And I mean, it was a 6-hour shakedown. I got in on a Friday night, and Saturday morning we had a shakedown, and 6 hours I sat there, and
right, couldn't move, couldn't do anything, right?
Huh?
Couldn't move, couldn't do anything, right?
I couldn't do anything.
Right.
And so yeah, in essence, I'm getting blamed for what's going on, and I just got there. But also, these guys, they're fucking pulling this shit. And I thought, now I talked to some of these deputies, and, you know, they're like, man, it makes our job harder when you're fucking breaking the law.
Yeah, but it doesn't take a whole lot in order for them to consider you're breaking the law. If you get into their time and make them have to work, that's what they consider causing a problem. And that's when they come in and they roll the units, not just fighting, but also if you make them have to do any extra work. They don't want to do any more than they have to.
If I may interject something here, gentlemen, it's a classic example of it's just like Prohibition. Because a few people mess up in society, everybody needs to be arrested for owning drugs. And if one guy messes up in a cell, in a tank, then everybody needs to be punished. And that ain't America. That ain't really liberty.
And I agree with that wholeheartedly. But, you know, when you're locked down, and all I want to say is, like I said, I was playing the devil's advocate. They're all officers that work these jails are not bad. Harris County is worse than Chambers County.
Absolutely.
Because Harris County, those guys all have bad attitudes. But you gotta look at how many people they crank through that system. And this is where we gotta fight and fix why those people are going into the system in the first place. So, you know, these guys, a lot of these officers that work the jails, the jailers, they're just taking their $10 an hour job.
They make a little more than that.
Not much.
Okay.
And you look at what they have to put up with. I mean, you were in the system. You know how bad a lot of those guys are. You know how bad of an attitude those people have.
David, now, I have to interrupt you here and say, these guys get paid for this. They choose to go to work each day. If they don't want to do it, then get the heck out, you know? The point of it is, lots of people need a job in this city, in this state, thanks to the Bush economy. And, you know, people can't piss and moan about their situation. They need to deal with it and do it right, as according to law.
And I agree wholeheartedly, but you know what? I don't take jobs that I don't want to, but you know how much I make a month? I make $200 a month.
Well, that's, you need to look for another job there.
No, because I don't want to take a jailer's job so that I can live inside of the system.
I don't think anybody wants to take a jailer's job.
These people don't understand how that they can't live, you know? And I'm rambling here, but the other point I want to bring up is Chambers County is the worst county jail system that I've ever been into. They pulled me over for a DWI, and they estimated a minimum of 30 days before I went to court if I didn't bail out.
Right. Sure. They want to drag it out as long as you can to get that state fund.
That's right.
Well, that or to get you to plead guilty, knowing full well you're going to have to wait forever and a half to go to trial.
Right.
That's
break it down.
Major, major problem. Chambers County's the worst. I've experienced Travis County, Oasis County, Harris County, Brazoria County, all kinds of offenses. Chambers County is the worst, and I think that we need to focus some attention on those people, because I sat in there with these guys, and they're frustrated because they're sitting there for 6 months before they even go to court.
A lot of them are sitting there for 6 to 8 months before they go to TDC after they've been sentenced, because TDC is full.
Well, I mean, there's people in Chambers County that have a warrant on them that's a TDC warrant, and they're sitting there for 6 months waiting to get their misdemeanor charge in Chambers County before they can even go to TDC, and then you have the overpopulation problem in TDC.
Right.
The whole system is all kinds of f***ed up, and I mean, and that's what I'm saying. I agree with everything that y'all are saying, and I just wanted to play the devil's advocate that not all jailers are bad, that they deal with a lot of f***ed up people in that system, because these people don't always play by the rules. I agree with legalizing drugs and sports cars, but when these people are smoking crack and killing kids over it, you know.
Well, David, that's a whole other discussion. We do appreciate your call. I could go on for an hour and try to negate everything you're saying, but let's just leave it at that for now. We do have more callers. Thank you, David.
Cool.
All right.
Later.
Okay. Right quick. Let's go ahead then. Who's been online here the most?
Ann.
Is it Ann? Hello, Ann.
Hey.
Good evening. Do you have a question for Tony?
Good evening, Dean. I do have a question for Tony. Recently, I had a very close companion that was incarcerated in the Harris County Jail, and he came home with just incredible stories of the officers abusing inmates, being extremely belligerent. Even the black officers were racist against the black inmates, and even stories of brutality. And I figured since Tony had been in there for a little bit, he might have seen some of this.
Yeah, I've seen a little bit of things that went on. Sometimes the deputies turn a blind eye to things that go on between the inmates based upon the time that they've been in there. But the deputies, every once in a while, they get a chip on their shoulder, and they're liable to confront an inmate and willing to call him out. They'll drop their belt and go downstairs and make an example out of him. Never saw it come to fisticuffs, but I've seen a lot of things happen in a lot of words. You know, they tried to provoke the inmate so that the inmate could take a swing at the officer. And immediately when something like that would happen, the first thing the deputies do, hit the panic button. They shut the unit down. They roll the whole unit from one end to the other. They take just about, you know, kind of what we were talking about with David a while ago, all the contraband and things like that. They take anything that's not in original containers, like your coffee and stuff like that. If you take it out of the original package, you lose it because it's considered contraband when it's not. But yeah, the deputies, they abuse the privilege to a point, or their job to a point of sometimes going a little bit far. Their wife, they might have not had a good time with their wife and not been able to go out and have dinner with her, and they're upset, or their wife's upset with them. So you know, yeah, they bring their attitudes to work with them. They really do. I appreciate you calling, though, Gail. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Okay, I wanted to respond to that a little bit, too. I think it ties into what the last caller said, David,
right,
that these guys hate their job, and it gives them an opportunity to kind of vent a little anger by taking it out on prisoners because, well, hell, who's going to stop them? let's go ahead and run a little bit more of our interview with Jacob Saul.
Okay, you know, you write a regular column for Reason Magazine. Could you tell the listeners where they might be able to read that column?
Yeah, the column is actually, it's a syndicated column which is carried by Reason Online, which is www.reason.com. And it's posted there every Friday morning. It's also available on Town Hall online and, you know, in a bunch of different newspapers like the New York Post or the Washington Times. So basically anybody who wants to subscribe to it can carry it. And if people like it, they should, you know, encourage their local papers to pick it up. There was a huge uproar, you know, back in the 60s and 70s about middle-class white kids getting arrested for smoking pot. And that outrage eventually led every state to change its law such that possession for personal use is treated as a misdemeanor at most, and in some cases it's just a citable offense. So that relieved a lot of pressure in it. I mean, it was obviously a good thing because a few people weren't going to prison anymore, going to jail anymore, for the most part, simply for, you know, smoking pot. But it also, at the same time, relieved pressure for more extensive reform. And so nowadays, I think there is a problem that when you tell people about the all of the drug offenders in prison, they tend to imagine people not like them, people who are potentially a threat to them, who probably they imagine are violent criminals anyway, and they just happen to get arrested on drug charges. That just happened to be what they got locked up for. So I think that perception needs to be addressed, and there is remarkably little information, actually, about who exactly these people are in prison and what, you know, their criminal history is like. One researcher who's tried to take a closer look at this is John DeUlio, who's a well-known criminologist. He's actually known as a sort of lock-them-up-and-throw-away-the-key kind of guy. But he, for a long time, had been skeptical that drug offenders, you know, included a lot of people who are innocent in the sense they've never really hurt anybody. They never committed crimes against people, and that their only offenses were drug offenses. He always thought that that was a really small group. But his own research, where he looked at people being sentenced for drug offenses in several different states, convinced him that, in fact, it's quite a substantial percentage. It may even be most drug offenders in some states, like New York, who basically not only drug offenses what they happen to be charged with, but they have no history of committing any other crimes, and they have not been convicted of those crimes either, obviously. But even when you look into crimes that they might not have been charged with, in other words, these are not thugs who are were they not in prison on a drug charge, would be a threat to you. I don't think that's widely recognized. I think certainly the government wants to give you the impression that these are all bad people.
Okay, again, that's Jacob Sullen, the author of Saying Yes in Defense of Drug Use, a great book. I recommend that you get it, give it a good read. Tony, we're kind of running out of time here. I just wonder if, you know, what's the lesson learned? Just don't get busted.
Yeah, that's the main thing right there. Don't get busted. I don't know. I guess you have to just play the system and do what they expect you to do, because once you get trapped into it, you just have to deal with it, because otherwise they're going to take you and they're going to put you into their system so they can make a living off of you and put your family in trouble.
So that's what when I'm asked to give speeches at events here now and then, one thing I keep telling people is they want to eat us alive. We do have one more caller online. We have James on line 3. Let's go ahead and bring him up. James?
Hey, how's it going tonight?
Good evening, James. We appreciate your call. How can we help you?
I'm a 36-year-old white male who's been through the Harris County jail system.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. I want to refer back to what the last caller before the interview. I'm sorry.
David?
If you'd just give me... No, the woman who called right after him.
Okay, go ahead.
She had made a mention about how black Harris County sheriffs who were in the jail guarding were, like, racist themselves against black inmates. And the point is that once you're in that the system of the law enforcement brotherhood, it doesn't matter what color you are, what religion you are, whatever. That's what comes first in your life, and that's wrong. The other point I wanted to make was that the justice system and the healthcare system are bureaucracies that should not be about making money.
I agree.
Once you make those two systems a capitalist system, they are bastardized.
Dang right, screwed and tattooed. You bet.
And that's why the system is messed up right now.
Well, every aspect of it, whether it's the prison guards or the prison builder, the piss tester or the, you know.
The justice system is about making money. It's wrong.
Right. It's not about rehabilitating
anyone. The
justice
system is about truth. That's all it's about, is finding the truth of what happened in any given incident.
Right, but I've never met anyone that's been arrested on any kind of a drug case, misdemeanor, felony, or anything, whether it was state or federal, either one, that the judges or the DAs or even their own attorneys, even if they're personal attorneys, very few people are willing to listen to what you've got to say. And anytime you tell them it wasn't yours and it was in the car, first thing they're going to say is, yeah, that's right, and the other guy, it wasn't theirs either. And they don't want to hear the truth, because the truth means they have to do more work.
Yep.
Exactly.
Tony, you took exacting notes while you were in lockup there, and your holding area had approximately 41 people. One day you did kind of a census.
Right.
And out of 41 people, how many were there for drug charges?
39. Yeah, the other two were on assault, and one of them was on a child, paying child support. You know, he had got about 6 months behind, and him and his wife got into a fight. And she told him that she was going to turn him in on that. The rest of them were all drug cases, from, you know, minor felonies to, you know, large cases. But everyone was there, like I said, 99%.
Were stacked from drug cases to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
The system is designed to where if you don't have enough money to swim your way out of the system, you drown in the system.
Yeah, if I'd had a lot of money, I probably could have bought my way out.
Easily, of course.
But that's another story.
If you don't have enough money, the system sets up to where you go on probation or parole, and they tell you, oh, you have to have a job, but we revoke your license, so you can't get to your job.
Right. Yeah. If I make a mistake, I'm going to TDC. They already told me that. Any mistake I make in the next 5 years, my deferred, I'm going to TDC for 5 years. They've already promised me that.
Yeah. It's a horrendous mess. James, we appreciate your call. To all the callers.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, James.
I appreciate all of you for calling in. Let's go ahead and hear the closing comments from Jacob Sullen.
Jacob, I want to thank you for joining us today on the New York Times and here on Cultural Baggage. I'm hoping that more and more people will read your book and begin to understand the truth that you're relaying there.
Well, thank you. Thanks for giving me the chance to talk to you.
Well, sure. And we're fixing to play a song. It's called The Ballad of Dennis Perrone. And it has a comment in there I'd like you to maybe close out with a look at. And it says, how many times must we be the victims of victimless crimes?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, people keep asking me, you know, what is the critical mass you have to reach before there are going to be changes? But I think that, you know, he's sort of focused on the essence of it, which is that you have to show that people are being punished unjustly for behavior that does not violate other people's rights, and then in fact in most cases isn't even harming the people who are doing it, which is, you know, one of the points I emphasize in my book, and they understand what's going on. I think the only way that you can support the laws is if you have a whole series of misconceptions about who drug users are.
I want to thank you again, Jacob. Folks, you've been listening to Jacob Sullen, the author of Saying Yes in Defense of Drug Use. I thank you, sir.
Sure.
Jacob, it'll be, you know, you can listen in tonight if you like, or it'll be on my website, cultural-baggage.com, starting tomorrow.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And I do want to thank Jacob. He's a great guest. He's all over the place. He's on the C-SPAN radio stations across the country, in the New York Times, etc. Very busy fellow with a very specific goal, and that's to end this crazy madness of the drug war. We want to pay a tribute to a friend. It is with great sadness that today I must report the passing of one of the great drug reformers of the U.S. One of the recipients of this year's Peter McWilliams Award, Cheryl Lee Miller of Toms River, New Jersey. Despite the debilitating effects of multiple sclerosis, she has fought the ravages of this disease and fought the establishment in trying to legalize and legitimize the use of medical marijuana. Always willing to fight the pain in order to accomplish her goal, here is an example of her work for the Libertarian Party in trying to defeat one of the great drug warriors of this country, Bob Barr.
Why does Bob Barr want this woman in jail?
I am Cheryl Miller. I have multiple sclerosis. I use medical marijuana. My Bob thinks I should be in jail or using my medicine. Why would you do that to me, Bob?
When the drug war turns on our own sick and dying, it's gone too far, and so has Bob Barr.
Why would you do that to me, Bob?
And just who is most directly responsible for this persecution of MS, AIDS, and cancer patients here in the United States? It seems it's one John Ashcroft, our Attorney General. Here is what next week's guest on Cultural Baggage, James P. Gray, thinks of Mr. Ashcroft.
John Ashcroft is one of the most dangerous people in our country today. What he is doing with regard to the Constitution should cause concern, deep concern, for everyone in the United States of America. He is attacking the law of the state of California. He is attacking medical marijuana here, for example, because he simply doesn't agree with it. But even though he doesn't agree with it, he is, in effect, arresting people and trying to convict and incarcerate people who are directly not only acting within the state law of California, they're actually working with the elected officials of the state and local governments, and even so, he is prosecuting them. I think this is abominable.
Through her hard work and dedication, Cheryl Miller has proven beyond any doubt that it's a great myth that marijuana leads to some amotivational syndrome. We send our condolences to her family and to the entire drug reform community. Her decades-long battle, her courage and perseverance in the face of overwhelming adversity is truly an inspiration. Cheryl, we will miss you. For their work as a grand deceptor, hypocrite, lying weasel, bigot, corporate whore, baby raper, superstitious shill, or ultra sinner, Cultural Baggage is proud to present the Coward of the Week. Okay, today's Coward of the Week is Judge Breyer, the man who sentenced Ed Rosenthal to one day in prison. Wonderful that you're still on the outside here with us, but some of the reports I'm seeing seem to indicate that you don't think Judge Breyer did you any favors. Would you discuss that?
Judge Breyer did me no favors, and he did the marijuana movement no favors. What he was trying to do was to ameliorate the bad situation that he had gotten himself into. Both public opinion and the media were so opposed to what he was doing that had he given me a harsh sentence, he would have been roundly condemned. You know, he was in a situation that was, they say, always be careful what you wish for, you just might get it. He was so interested in getting a conviction that he didn't realize what the situation would be for him after. During the trial, he knew that the prosecutor had lied to the grand jury, and he stated that, but he said that it was harmless. And he said that the grand jury would have indicted even without the lies. But we disagree with that. And I think that any time that a prosecutor lies to a grand jury, the whole procedure should be thrown out and started over. The second thing is that Breyer understood that we had the DE agent, Pickett, trapped in a vise of his own lies. So the judge stopped the questioning so that the DEA agent would not be discredited. And what that would have meant if he had been discredited, if he lied in my case, you know, you can presume that he lied in other cases before, and that would have ended his career. So the judge was more interested in hiding the truth than giving it. A third thing is that the judge refused to allow us to use the immunity clause, and that was that I was immune under federal law. And he said that a literal reading of this federal law would exonerate me. And then he used a more arcane reading of it, which he wasn't supposed to do. He refused to let us use estoppel as a defense. And under this concept, I would have been able to tell the jury that a government official with authority to do so had told me that what I was doing was legal. He tampered with the jury by removing people who had strong feelings about Prop 215, that's the medical marijuana initiative, or about states' rights, even though he declared that these weren't issues in the case. And then when jurors admitted that they had acted improperly by seeking a lawyer's advice, The judge declared it harmless error, although one juror said that it influenced her vote and other people's vote. And then the judge took over the direct cross-examination of one of our witnesses, not allowing my attorney to develop theories that he wished to, and the judge improperly interrupted the defense during closing argument. This judge was not a referee. He was more like a prosecutor, and that's why I attacked him. And finally, when he gave me my sentence, which I admit was one day and was very nice for me, it was like a sugar-coated poison pill, because he said that this was the last time that defendants could bring up any of the issues that I had brought up, so that they would be subject to the full brunt of federal law.
Okay, that was Ed Rosenthal. He's going to join us in a couple of weeks on Cultural Baggage. I want to alert you to the fact next week at this time, you'll hear The Other Side. And next Thursday, you'll hear Cultural Baggage. We're going to be on at 11 p.m. every Thursday. And I want you to mark your calendars for that. Next week, our guest will be Judge James P. Gray. He's written a book. It's called Why the Drug War Has Failed and What We Can Do About It, A Judicial Indictment of the War on Drugs. One more piece from Ed Rosenthal. Steve, if you would roll that.
What's next for you and reform? Where do you see us headed next?
Well, part of the reason why the DEA is so intent on stopping medical marijuana is that they know it's like if the marijuana laws are a wall, this is a major brick from the bottom of the wall. These laws are going to be coming tumbling down pretty quickly. I plan to be right out there telling the public about it and try to educate our politicians, going about doing everything I can in the campaign for civil regulation of marijuana, including not only medical marijuana, but all marijuana. The ending of my case will be a modification of the marijuana laws, and that will come from the Court of Appeals.
I certainly agree that it is coming, and I think you're the man to help expedite it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, well, I just wanted to thank the entire community who has supported me and that, you know, has been so concerned about me and that has helped in the case in so many different ways. And I just want to let people know that that these laws are doomed and I'm going to help bring them down.
I think Ed is the man to bring these laws down. He's certainly proven he's willing to stay the course and do what's necessary to get the job done. I want you all to consider, you know, visiting our website, cultural-baggage.com. We've got about 40 shows out there with judges and doctors and, you know, members of European Parliament, Nobel Prize winners. We have the information to help make the change, and we hope you will join in that effort. Please be sure and join us this coming Thursday, every Thursday, when Cultural Baggage will air at 11 p.m., and our guest next week will be Judge James P. Gray. I thank all the callers. I thank you, Tony, for being here.
Thank you for allowing me to be here.
Sure. Jacob Sullum and Ed Rosenthal and everybody who's participated. And I guess that's about it for this week. Thank you all. For my producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, The Unvarnished Truth.